they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole.
Get
we found
ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
All right, folks, welcome down the Security Rabbit Hole to another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast, episode 286, coming at you live from Frisco, Texas, with my good buddy Sean. I'm actually sitting in Mr. Tuma's office here today. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Raph, how you doing?
I love doing these in person.
Man, this is fun. This is the first one we've done in person.
I got to tell you, you have a badass office.
Well, you know, somebody's got to pay for all this stuff, right? And who pays for it? The people getting breached.
Right, exactly. The man with the name on the door says so. Look, folks, we're going to talk through a couple of the usual things. We're going to go through the cases that, not specifically, but kind of the disclosure laws and how they're changing and sort of what that means is how much you should run for cover, and then the right to sue and harm and all that other stuff. And Sean's always got opinions on that with anecdotes, so let's dive in. First and foremost, with GDPR and such, the time that you have to disclose a breach continues to, get smaller and smaller?
Yeah, we're looking at a 72-hour notification time now, which, it depends on what you're notifying about, though, right? Is it basically any incident, or is it a true privacy breach that causes harm? And that's something we're still kind of grappling with.
Well, and that's the challenge, right? Because breaches happen sometimes years before anybody's discovered it. But we keep going through this, and I've seen the argument happen on Twitter. I've seen this, people discuss this, and it's usually not by legal people, but which is why I'm glad I'm sitting across the table from you. But if you're an incident responder or you're somebody at an information security team, it has got to be the least fun thing to be thinking about all these different laws, especially if you're a multi-state, multinational corporation. Golly, right? Like, when we discovered it, when we notify, who we notify, how often, and all things involved in between there. What are the rules? What's new in that space?
Well, the first thing a company has to do before any of this ever happens is they have to do what I guess mistakenly call a risk assessment, which is assessing the risk of the company.
Yeah.
But I kind of got called out by someone on Twitter last week because apparently that's not a risk assessment. So you can call it a Sean risk assessment or analyzing your risk. But what you're trying to do is first of all, figure out, when you're looking at the risk to your company, what jurisdictions are you in? What rules are you subject to? What, governing authorities, whether it's contractual, or like PCI, or whether it's GDPR, in the EU, or whether it's the North Carolina law or the Texas law. You've got to know all that, and you have to understand what is the regulatory environment we're operating in. You've got to do that before an incident, hopefully. And then you basically figure out what's the most restrictive time period I'm dealing with, right? So if Texas requires notification within a reasonable amount of time.
I like the word reasonable.
Yeah, reasonable, right? And then you have some state that says no, notification within 30 days. And then, now North Carolina's proposing something like notification within 72 hours or a week or something like that. And then you have the GDPR saying 72 hours. You pick your most restrictive one and say that's what we've got to live with, because once you start sending out notifications, you better notify everybody at once. Otherwise, you're going to have a situation where the media gets a hold to it.
And then it's just ugly.
And I know that because right now, as we're sitting here, I'm dealing with one where it was discovered last week, normally we have a decent amount of time. The media found out about it a day later, and that made everything have to happen a whole lot quicker.
Yesterday, right?
Yesterday, yeah, by you know, the end of the week. And so, really, something that I encourage everybody to think very carefully about, and that is, we use this term data breach, and people think of data breach, but data breach is a legal definition. You know, and so ask yourself, is it an incident, which is something adverse that happened?
Right.
But it may not be a data breach unless it is legally reportable.
Right.
So we have incidents that may or may not be a data breach. You don't know it's a data breach until you find some legal standard that you have breached by allowing that information out into the wild or to be stolen. And so when we look at these notification laws, we have to ask ourselves, what is it that, when does the clock start to run? So if I'm sitting here and find out that we have some anomaly within our network, and it may have been an unauthorized access, some kind of an intrusion,
yeah,
but it only got into whatever is hosting our website and accessed the file for the information that's broadcast on our website. Okay, we've had an unauthorized access, an intrusion. We've had an incident, but there may not be any breach because we haven't had any access, any examination, or exfiltration of protected information.
So I suspect security folks need to be able to tread that and make sure they understand that carefully, because you use that B word once, and it's forever.
Then it's an admission.
Yeah.
I mean, once you say we've had a data breach, what lawyer's going to ever let you back away from that?
Yeah,
and then
there's
say,
no walking that
well,
back.
Well, actually, it was just an incident.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And a great example of that is we have some of these laws that they're proposing now that are saying we want to know. We want you to report when you have an incident. Or we have some companies. I was involved in negotiating with one last week, a very large bank that everybody probably know about, saying we want a report of every security incident.
That's absurd.
It's absurd. And obviously, and then later
how
in
many
another
pages?
Paragraph, they use something about data breaches. And I'm like, well, what do you mean?
Wow.
They had no idea.
Because so even the lawyers don't know.
Yeah, they didn't see the distinction between an incident and a breach. But if you had to report every incident that a company has.
Tens of hundreds, if not thousands, in large companies, right?
Right. And so I had an opportunity to talk to the AG for Texas and Vermont that pursue these kind of actions against companies at a conference last fall. And I asked them the question, when does the clock begin to run? And they said, you know, it's kind of a gray area. Because
when we decide.
It's when you learn, you know, that incident may be something more.
Right.
Or when you should have known, you know. And nobody knows the answer to that question.
Well, should have known is terrible.
That's right. Well, but as we're crafting these laws, and now every state wants to have the most aggressive law.
Right.
Because that shows they care about privacy, right?
Of course.
And so they're creating these laws, and nobody knows how to apply them. And that's where you get maybe the Equifax problem.
Yeah, well, yeah, wow. Because you've got, so maybe people don't know what you're talking about, right? So Equifax had their incident, which turned into a breach, and then they recently disclosed another 2.4 million, I think you said?
Yeah, another 2.4 million individuals who they're reporting were subject to this breach. But the interesting thing about it, when you look and see, at least from the reports they've made, what information was compromised for these 2.4 million people, it was only partial numbers from their driver's license, nothing else. And a partial number from a driver's license, not even the full number, is probably not independently something a company would normally have to report.
Yeah, and that's I imagine that to be the case. I mean, But now that the cat's sort of out of the bag, right? They've had an incident. Nobody's going to let them back away from that. What was it really? I mean, it doesn't matter. It could have been somebody's street address that you find in an address book, and it probably would have been, oh no, look, more data.
Yeah, exactly. What it shows is, once you get under the microscope, you know, once you get associated with a breach, especially one of this magnitude,
yeah,
perception means more than reality.
Oh, we've been seeing that quite a bit, right? Because, and we've been talking about on the podcast and in various things I've written on, is the importance of having a plan. And I look, when you were talking about all the different states and regulations and times and definitions, I don't know how many companies actually think about this before that day. But if you're not thinking about it, you're going to have a bad time, because there's not a pretty way that ends.
No, and there's not a quick and easy way that ends.
Oof.
And people still think security should be cheap and it should be easy. And they don't understand that it's really not either of those things. And once you've had an incident that is likely a breach, you no longer have the option. It's now mandatory that you comply with these laws. And if you don't know what the laws are, and you have
a lot
hours
of trouble. Yeah.
To comply, you don't even have time to assemble it all and to learn what you're dealing with.
Well, and then I imagine you end up saying some silly things that may or may not be true. But look, so let's go back to some of these, like, you know, 15 days, I think, is one of the Carolinas was, if I remember correctly, is what they were suggesting. In 15 days, right, say 2 business weeks, I don't know how much you can figure. I mean, if it's something small, okay, fine. But if it's any regular, by the time you get people, you know, into the environment, start assessing, start evaluating, what did they access, how much did they access, when did they have access, 2 weeks, that's a lot of time nobody's sleeping for.
Oh, exactly. Look, if I got a call right now saying, new client, didn't know him, saying, Sean, we have a data breach. And I have probably 6 or 7 active breaches going on right now that we're managing. And it's always like that.
Of course it is.
If they called right now, look, by the end of the day today, I could have a notification vendor set up, you know, to handle the logistics of mailing and providing the credit monitoring or credit product, and they could set up a call center within hours if we need it. We could have that done today. We could have a PR firm engaged by the end of the day. I can generally know from what they've told me whether we're likely a breach or we're likely a non-reportable incident, and we could kind of plan according to that.
Yeah.
We could have insurance handled, you know, their insurance notified. But what we couldn't have done is forensics.
Right.
Forensics is what takes the longest in a breach, because you're trying to find out what really happened.
Right.
And there's nothing I hate more than notifying a bunch of human beings just like me of some problem with their credit that's going to cause them to lose sleep at night when nothing really happened.
With a bunch of maybes.
With a bunch of maybes. Or that you and I both know sitting here really was not a problem.
Yeah.
Really was not a breach.
Yeah.
But because of the laws or the requirements, we've got to err on the side of caution, and we've got to over-notify, and that's what we have to do.
Well, look, and just because on CSI the case ends in an hour, right, wraps it up nicely, forensics, we know, takes days, hours, weeks, sometimes months, and computers are spread across the globe. Sometimes the ones that were breached, I mean, this is a fun twist, right? Now everybody's moving to the cloud.
Yeah.
The fun twist is, well, those servers were breached. Oh, can you produce evidence from those machines? Well, they were up and down. We don't have those; are gone. You're like, what? Well, you need evidence. How does that even work? What do you tell people in that case?
Well, then you have to go and look at your contractual agreements and see what did they obligate themselves to do.
Oh God!
You know, the hosts, right?
Yeah.
And then what if they tell you, so what? You have a contract, but we can't do it. What do you do? Do you hold a gun to their head? I mean, do you threaten them with a lawsuit?
Yeah.
Well, big deal. I mean, at that point, it may impact them 6 months from now.
Oof.
But what can you do today to get the evidence you have to conduct your investigation? And there's really not a whole lot. If you don't have some leverage or control over
yeah.
it. You know, if you're a huge multinational enterprise level corporation that has a lot of power, you can probably get things done. If you're a small mid-sized business, you're stuck because they're not bending over backwards to make things happen. And so, you know, those are just the kind of twists that make every one of these incidents different. And when companies are not prepared, it makes it a whole lot more difficult because they don't have any way of navigating this process.
Except for calling you and hoping to God that you know more than they do.
That's right. And that's if they call me. Because what happens a lot of times, unfortunately, is they call some guy that they know from, you know, playing poker with or something. And they say, yeah, it's probably not a big deal. Don't worry about it. You know, and then they start hearing about it from the press or whatever else. And then that manageable problem becomes a much more unmanageable
Vastly
problem.
Vastly unmanageable. Yeah, I mean, look, how many times do you talk to somebody who that calls you on that worst day of their corporate lives at that point where they are actually prepared, like they can answer questions you're giving them? Is that getting better over the last year or so?
It is getting better. We are seeing more people be more prepared, and they at least understand what they're in for. I mean, I still get the people who I've been explaining this to for years, pre-breach, saying you need to get a risk management program in place, and they thumb their nose at me. And then they have an incident, and I've had more than a couple that have then had an incident, and then they get mad at me because I can't solve it immediately. I can't just make it all go away. And I'm like, what do you think we've been telling you?
Man, that aware. So, like, look, the industry's been pounding on awareness for forever. And you think the thing that we keep saying is, well, there'll be this watershed event and everybody will take notice. And how many of those do we need before everybody takes notice? And,
you know, I've been doing this kind of work since 1999 in some form or another.
Yeah.
In 2011, we thought that was the year of the data breach. We thought back then that things were really going to turn. That was like the Heartland time.
Yeah.
And some a couple.
It's
got to
be getting worse every year.
Yeah, and then in 2014, right when we were learning about the details of Target, Home Depot, Neiman Marcus, all that. At the beginning of 2014, it really seemed like it was going to shake companies up, and it moved the needle a lot.
Yeah.
But then the Sony hack came down. Right at the end
that
of the
was
year.
It. That was the one everybody. No, that was
yeah,
it.
Yeah, because it wasn't stealing data; it was putting a company out of business.
Yeah, guess what? That did
it. It didn't.
I hear
do
it was
it.
Still there.
It didn't do it. And so then we got the really big shakeup with Equifax, right?
Yeah.
And in September, there were all these new laws being proposed and hearings and all this. And the only reason we're really talking about Equifax in the news right now is because of these newly discovered driver's license numbers. So it's like nothing is really that one event that's a huge wake-up call. And I don't think anything... WannaCry. I mean, last May, WannaCry.
Yeah.
That was impacting all kind of companies didn't do it. So I think we're just in for the slow, steady kind of trying to get companies aware when they'll listen. And then when they won't, they pay a price for it.
Man, how does it when somebody comes in and they're calling you and they're like, "Hey, Sean, we've got this thing. It's gonna be we think it's gonna be a problem, but here's what we know." And you know, you've got their questions or whatever right laid out. What's the time delta? How much faster can you go with somebody that's at least some level of prepared versus somebody that's like, "Hey, something bad happened. We're not quite sure what's up."
Days.
Wow.
Days faster. Because somebody that's not prepared still doesn't appreciate the magnitude of what has happened. And they're still trying to, they're still in denial. Someone who's prepared usually knows what happened, and they're ready to jump in and start mitigating it as quickly as possible. And that's a huge point.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the incidents I see that become breaches or that are breaches, they usually don't start out terribly bad. Now, some do. I mean, some you just got taken down and there's nothing you can do about it. But a fair number of them would have been much more manageable early on. You know, a simple intrusion with someone using RDP access to tinker around or you know, whatever they're doing, right? But they're not detected, or they're detected and they're ignored.
Yeah.
And then they're not only, you know, mining crypto over here on one side, but they're exfiltrating healthcare data on the other.
Yeah.
Now you've got all kind of issues.
Yeah, and then you don't know what to go after because you've got all sorts of... So that I think that becomes a challenge as I've seen companies start implementing more and more, like the endpoint discovery, EDR kind of tools and detection remediation and discovery and you know, data categorization tools and such. We're pushing towards the more towards the rather than just, oh, something happened, let's kick the bad guy out, but what happened, how bad is it, like what got taken, can we tell? Because long time ago in my employ, there was a it wasn't quite the kind of data breach you expect where somebody hacked in, but there was data that went missing, and because we couldn't exactly say what they could, what exactly with a for fact was taken or how much, we had to assume it was everything.
That's right.
And that is ugly.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes the most important thing that your tools can tell you is not what happened, but what didn't happen.
Yeah.
You
the
know,
scope.
What wasn't impacted.
The magnitude, right?
Exactly. I mean, if you can tell me HR records were impacted, but health records and you know, patient health information wasn't impacted, that's a whole lot better.
That is a whole lot better.
You know, and people don't think about that. But the other thing is, you know, I do a fair number of ransomware cases right now.
Are those considered breaches?
They're certainly breaches if you're in healthcare.
Interesting.
They are presumed a breach in healthcare unless you can prove otherwise.
So you have to prove...
You have to go through a criteria and basically prove otherwise.
Wow.
And so the problem is... we had one that got out of hand because the hackers weren't out of the system.
Oh.
And when they find out that they've been caught and you don't kick them out, they get real nasty.
Duh.
You know? And so when you engage in that fight, you better engage with everything you've got. And the proper artillery or special forces,
yeah,
or whatever. Suddenly
you're in a
knife
fight with a guy with a cannon.
That's right. You better, when you enter that fight, you better be ready to have really good people to make sure they're out and you keep them out. And it's usually, you know, not the IT guy that's just a hobbyist that's going to do that.
Yeah, and that means having a retainer. How many companies do you work with that have the level of sort of specialist expertise that can do kind of advanced forensic, advanced, you know, threat removal, I guess we'll call it, pest extermination extraordinaire?
Internally, probably I'd say 25% have really good people, but most of them, but here's the other thing that I tell them is, if we're treating this as a breach from day one, okay, and you know we're going to be notifying, and we're basically just saying we're screwed. Just put it all out there. Let's try to manage the crisis in that way. It's okay if you're relying on the information from your internal team. If we have to, we have to, right? But if we're going to take the position that this is a non-reportable incident, and we're going to be relying on the examination of professionals looking and parsing
through. I see where you're going with this.
We don't want to be relying on the guy who's getting a paycheck from the company making that final decision.
Yeah.
You've got to have outside experts.
So retainers are required. But here's the thing, right? So I've, you know, having some experience with companies that do retainers, that kind of stuff, like you're basically, you know, it's an insurance policy, really, right?
Yeah.
Because you're paying somebody, much like they pay attorneys, right, that say, okay, when I need you, you'll be here, and we'll be ready to go. But some of these larger breaches started with calling somebody, and you have to call around because those retainer companies are busy. And if you don't have one, that's a really crappy time to try to negotiate one, because you're going to be paying whatever that rate is to show up tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it's going to be expensive.
That's one more really good reason among a ton for having good cyber insurance. Because a lot of times, even if you don't have those relationships in place, the cyber insurance carrier, if they're a good carrier, they'll have a panel of approved people in place.
That makes sense.
To direct you exactly where to go. Now, obviously, I don't like that if it's someone I'm not on their approved panel for an insurance carrier, because that means the attorney's going to usually be someone else.
Right, right.
But it is a benefit for the client. Because a lot of times they have pre-negotiated rates,
retainers,
prices for forensics that are discounted, and all of that stuff.
Man, I got to tell you that with near certainty, we can say that every company's going to have that day at some point if they already haven't, right? And the magnitude may be big, magnitude may be small. You may have an incident, you may have a breach, but knowing the difference between the two. You know, I still don't see budgets accommodating that kind of particularly security budgets accommodating that kind of bad day. That usually comes out of some other like slush fund somewhere.
That's what I try to explain to people is when they say we don't have the budget, you know, to do the proactive things that need to be. I said, well, take it out of your breach response budget.
They're like, what?
And then, well, we don't have that either. I'm like, exactly. You don't have a choice. And that one's a whole lot bigger. And when it happens, you must do it. So, you know, be proactive and do what you can. We're never going to prevent all this.
No, we're not.
Right. But we can minimize the risk.
We've got to get better at because look, we mentioned this earlier as we were talking, and I've gotten some of these I've gotten my share of letters, as I'm sure you have, right? And you just sort of go, eh, another one. Yeah. But the ones that scare me are ones that you read and go, I don't think you know what you're saying. I got one from a healthcare provider that my twins went to early on, and it was something to the effect of, yeah, we found a virus in our network, so we're notifying you of a potential breach. I'm like, what?
You found one virus? That was it?
Like, man, you are having a good day. What day was that?
Well, and that's part of the problem I'm seeing right now is we have a lot of new legal experts in this area, you know, who haven't yet learned. You're scared. Look, I wake up at night scared to death. Every night or every morning about what I don't know about the law and the industry and everything else.
Yeah.
Because the consequences are so grave.
Yeah.
If you screw it up.
Yeah.
And so when you get a call as an attorney, the safe bet is to say, yeah, you have a breach, give notice, you know, go through the process, and then nobody's going to criticize you for that.
Yeah.
But a lot of these breaches aren't breaches.
Yeah.
They're non-reportable incidents that people don't understand how to handle that and to analyze that. And so companies are sometimes they're getting bad advice of saying, oh, ignore it, it's no big deal. But they're getting bad advice of saying, report, 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 because that's the safe bet. When you really need to gather information.
Figure out which one it is.
And figure out which one it is. But with these compressed time periods now, we may not be able to do that as much.
So that was my argument when I saw this, when I first started seeing these like short period reporting cycles was, well, these are clearly written by people who have never actually been in an organization that is currently being, you know, having to deal with a breach, right? Because you wouldn't say things like, yes, you need to notify within 24 hours. Like, what are you going to tell people?
Right.
Like, hey, we had something happen. People go, okay.
Yeah, what else?
Thanks.
Or they assume the worst. And then you're putting their lives in chaos
for no
reason.
Right.
And that's what I hate seeing. Because I've felt it. I've been in... I mean, I receive those letters. I know what it's like.
Yeah.
And I hate doing that because it doesn't serve anyone's best interest. It doesn't do the company spending resources now notifying when they should be spending resources, remediating and repairing. But the other side of that is something has to start waking companies up too. And because we're still not getting the kind of proactive, serious level of interest that we should be getting. And the regulators know that, and that's why they're hitting them.
Well, you think they, I mean, because look, can we regulate that? I mean, that's the concern I have is, will regulation actually fix that? Because we've talked about this a million times, right? Law is not really the up to date vehicle you want, right? Law is always going to be a little behind, and it's kind of the blunt force object, right? That you're gonna hit something with. You don't want to go. You don't really want to lead with that. You want to self-govern, self-police whenever possible. I don't know. It just seems tough to say, let the law handle it and kind of let it go at that.
It is tough. And I'm experiencing that right now because I'm drafting. I'm a co-chair of a committee that's drafting proposed national data breach legislation to get rid of the 48 and have one for at least certain industries.
Is this going to be, is 2018 going to be the year, or is it going to be 2028?
I was in Congress last May and had very candid discussions with some of the members, and it didn't matter if it was Republican, Democrat, House, Senate, staffers, or what. They all seemed to be pretty confident that nothing was ever going to get completed.
That's no surprise.
Just because
the differences.
It's the politics. Yeah. It's the gamesmanship of who controls it, who owns it, right? And then Equifax seemed to re-motivate a lot of people.
For like 15 minutes.
But then we're seeing it kind of die back down.
And it did. It's gone. I mean, it's pretty much left a news cycle. Other things will happen.
Yeah.
Moving on.
And the problem is, while it's nothing's happening on the federal level, a lot's happening on the state levels.
Yeah.
And it's just making this problem much, much worse. Because having 48 states with their own ideas, okay, here's the real problem, all right? When we're talking about cyber laws in general, we're talking about three kinds of laws. We're talking about your unauthorized access,
yeah,
like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Yep.
That's the
which
one
we all know and love.
We love, yeah. That says you can't go commit mischief on somebody else's network or as an insider within certain jurisdictions, right? Okay, that's your unauthorized access law. Then we have the security laws, which are the ones that say you must protect information by doing X, Y, and Z.
Yep.
The protection side. And then we have the privacy laws, which are the ones we've been talking about the whole time.
Yeah.
The breach notifications that are saying if you compromise someone's data, they have a right to know about it to protect themselves. So we have those three buckets. All right, people don't realize we have three buckets. They think of breach notification as being your big law. They don't even think of unauthorized access as having a part in this whole game. But what we're having happen is we have 48 states with varying degrees of different privacy-based breach notification laws.
Yeah.
That's saying what you have to do after an incident happens or a breach, right?
Yeah.
And they have sometimes different definitions of breach.
That's the part that drives me nuts. So, definition, there's no standard language.
That's right. So there's one level of confusion. Now we have a state like Texas that says, you know, you must take reasonable safeguards to protect information. Something like that.
I love the word reasonable in there.
We can live with that, right?
Yeah.
But then you have New York with the Department of Financial Services cybersecurity regulations that have 19 pages of specificity about what you must do to protect information, that you must have a program, what that program must contain. Then you have to sign off on compliance, right? That's a security-based that has the notification component tied into it. Then you have Colorado following up with their version for financial services that's very specific. What happens when you have 48 states telling organizations you must take these specific standards to protecting data?
Well, now we're not even counting beautiful Hawaii or Alaska.
No, they're in that. But maybe Guam? I think Guam's in there too somewhere.
Yeah.
But what about the GDPR?
Well, it's kind of interesting, right? Because they're talking about somebody was talking about the other day in the news cycle about a U.S. America's answer to GDPR, and I'm going, "Oh, good. Let's create another one."
Well, I'll tell you what's funny. I like the GDPR. I don't hate the GDPR.
No, I don't. I think it's reasonable.
And I'll give you a story of why. I had a client from the UK contact me and say, hey, we want to get in compliance with the US laws. So, okay, great. So we got on an hour-long conference call, and we talked about the nature of their business, and it touches healthcare.
Okay.
It touches financial services.
Oh, boy.
It's going to be all over the U.S.
Oh, good.
Okay. And so, you know, and it may, they will do business with publicly traded companies, so they're going to be in the line of some of the SEC reporting issues.
Woo! All right?
So the privacy officer says, well, look, why don't you just send me the law and I'll take a look at it and then we'll reconvene. I'm like, no, you don't understand. There is no law in the U.S. There are 48 states.
Yeah.
There's HIPAA,
yeah,
you know, in high tech. There's the FTC that everybody has to pay attention to. There's the SEC, right? And then there's financial regulations that you need to look at. There is no one law. You've got to look at all of these. You know, and then the guy goes, well, this is going to be really expensive, isn't it? Well, yes, it will be.
And it's not going to be done by tomorrow.
That's right. And
yes, I will send you all. I will send all 50 states with the laws, and I will put them in a giant crate. It will be delivered by Maersk, in sometime in a month, because it's going to require two forklifts. And good luck reading all that.
Exactly. And so something like the GDPR, in concept, makes, you know, streamlines a lot of that.
Yeah,
but then you do have your different variables for different industries that don't always need the same levels of regulation. So we have a mess on our hands.
And then, of course, then there's the last part of this, which is good luck if you're the victim, right?
Yeah, good luck if you're the victim. If you're really the victim, right?
That's true.
Okay, because number one, have you really been harmed? And if you've been harmed, how do I know It was Equifax or, you know, Target or whatever else company out there that's got
my
information.
You have to prove explicitly that it was.
Yeah.
There's really no winning this, is there? This is just a giant flaming pile of.
Let me tell you what I tell clients when they want to go have legal battles at court. Tell them, you know, your business is doing your business.
Yeah.
My business is fighting about all this, okay? Guess who wins no matter what?
You do.
Me. The only people who win legal battles are the lawyers on each side.
Right? Yeah, fair enough.
And because we're getting paid to do what our business is. The business is losing money, effort, focus, because they're in something they don't belong in. And so avoidance is really where it starts, but we have had a recent update on this breach litigation front with the CareFirst case that really was going up to the Supreme Court, or trying to get it to the Supreme Court, to resolve this circuit split about, you know, whether you can have whether fear of future harm is not enough to get you into the courthouse.
Right.
And the way it turned out, the case that was appealed, the court had found that, in essence, this fear, this future harm, was enough to get you into the courthouse at a motion to dismiss stage.
Right.
Okay. And so
winning the case, but just bringing it to court.
Right. The Supreme Court said, we're not going to hear it yet, sent it back down to let the circuit courts continue to try to work out something, you know. It's like the winnowing process.
Yeah,
figuring out the good arguments, the bad arguments, trying to come up with something workable. And so this led to a lot of commentary of saying, you know, ooh, Supreme Court denied the CareFirst case. So, you know, look out here. The plaintiffs are going to, you know, have more success in their cases. I don't really see it as that, because this was deciding a case at the motion to dismiss stage.
All right.
And all that really means is I write a complaint, I file it, and I say the company X did, you know, this, this, and this wrong, caused me harm.
Yeah.
The defendant comes in without any evidence, any discovery, any witnesses, and says, you did not even meet the bare bones threshold of establishing a case based just upon what you filed at the motion to dismiss stage. And the courts have been throwing those out, okay, in this care first, you know,
didn't get thrown out.
It didn't get thrown out, so it looks like it's going to make it beyond that. But then you still have the whole evidentiary.
Yeah, you actually still have to produce evidence.
That's right. You have to produce evidence, and then you get to a motion for summary judgment stage, and that's where you look at it and say, based upon the evidence that's been discovered,
yeah,
we find you do not have a claim because of X, Y, and Z, and that's where they're going to make them prove their damages.
Yeah.
Okay, well, until a case gets past summary judgment, you're not even getting close to trial.
Well, yeah, and I imagine that by the time, if a company were to take it to that level, by the time all is said and done, the victims get like $1.50 and a happy heart, you know, pat on the back 9 years later when the courts are done battling it, right?
Right.
These aren't things that are gonna, like, if I got the letter today, it doesn't mean I'm getting, you know, money to cover all the potential loss whatever's.
You're gonna get money put in a pool.
Yeah.
Like we've seen with the settlements for Target, yeah, and Home Depot or whoever.
And
else.
Then once you can prove that you were actually a victim, but by the time you pay an investigator, by the time you do the research, it probably costs you more than you're like, at that point, it's like, you know.
Well, the class action cases, the plaintiffs aren't paying out of pocket.
Okay.
Right? It's the attorneys usually advancing the money for the investigation,
yeah,
and the filing fees and all that. And so that's why whenever there's a big resolution, the money goes to pay back those expenses,
yeah, yeah,
and then the legal fees come out, and then whatever's
left over, the victims actually get. And so that kind of brings us to this. I'll just kind of leave it at this then, Sean. With all the crazy that go between the law itself continuing to evolve in this amorphous, horrible, scary blob that we know you're damned if you don't prepare. You're still probably damned if you do prepare. And on the victim side, on both sides of the victim, right? Because the company that got breached is a victim. The end users,
that's right,
of that company
are
still victims.
They are usually in the focus of a criminal attack.
Yeah.
Was it preventable? Maybe. I don't know. But we lose sight of that criminal side of that as well. That's the unauthorized access laws.
Well, this, I think you and I are going to retire before any of this gets resolved in any meaningful way. And until then, it's going to be muddy all the way through.
Yeah, you know, this whole cybercrime, it's human nature, okay?
Yeah.
It's human beings found a more efficient way of committing bad acts,
yeah,
and it's by using the exponential power of computers,
yeah,
instead of driving a truck up and backing it up to the front door and loading it with files,
yeah,
and boxes,
yeah,
or products. And until human nature gets fixed, right?
Yeah.
Or a new, more efficient way of theft comes along, you know, this will continue to be a problem.
Boy. Well, in that case, until then, we're all going to have jobs.
I like the sound of that.
Hey, Sean, thanks for joining us again. This has been fun.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, folks, thanks for listening. I'm kind of sad that we just never actually have any good resolution to this. It's more wait and see, and, you know, more of the same. But that's the reality, I guess, right?
That is the reality.
All right. Well, thank you, Sean. Mr. Tuma, once again, it's been a pleasure hanging out with you.
It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it. We got to do this again.
As we will, now that I'm in Dallas regularly.
Exactly.
All right, folks. Thanks for listening. This has been another Down a Security Rabbit Hole podcast, episode 286, as we get on into close to 300. And thanks for listening. We will catch you guys another time, another place, on another Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Ciao.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. Our website is whiterabbit.net, whiterabbit.net. So on behalf of Rafal, James, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.